Thank you very much, Barbara, for that introduction. And I'd like to just acknowledge some ancestors who've played a part in my being here today. One is Martha Helming, who invited me to come in 2011 when I spoke about my book on Walt Whitman. My former mentor analyst, Donald Sandner, who played a very important role in inspiring me to read Emily Dickinson in 1995, when I wrote my first essay on her, a 70-page essay. And Emily Dickinson herself. I want to begin with a couple of lines from Emily Dickinson's poetry to give you a feeling for who she was and what she has to teach us. This one, safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, lie the meek members of the resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. The meek members of the resurrection. What's she talking about here? Do we die, she asks in another poem, or is this death's experiment reversed in victory? One crucifixion is recorded only. How many be is not affirmed by mathematics or by history. Our Lord indeed made compound witness, and yet there's newer, nearer crucifixion than that. So, good morning. I know you're all wondering, those of you who've heard me speak here before, about what I've been up to since my last talk here on vocational dreams. As you can see from my book, I have been busy getting my book ready for publication. It was published recently by Kingfisher Press on March 21st, right after the spring equinox, and also happens to be my wife Lori Goldrich's birthday. So it was a gift to have it published in March, Emily Dickinson's favorite time of the year. And this morning what I want to meditate on for you is what happens in the psyche of a woman who undergoes a spiritual metamorphosis or a transformation through profound internal experience that later finds its way into lyrical verses that produce what she defined as bolts of melody. Coming from the lightning that struck her again and again from the transcendent dimension. Thunder and lightning was very significant, very important to Emily Dickinson's evolution. As a child of 2 years old, she was taking a walk with her aunt Lavinia on the road to Monson, near her home in Amherst. And there was a sudden thunder storm that frightened her. And she saw the lightning and told her aunt, "Please take me home." So Aunt Lavinia covered her head with a cloak and took the child to her home in Monson. This was the first experience of what she would call nature's God, the profound manifestation of energy in the cosmos, finding its way into manifestation in this electrical storm. I was very influenced in my studies by a book by Marie-Louise von Franz, a student of Carl Gustav Jung, who wrote a book, Projection and Recollection in Jungian Psychology. In this book, von Franz outlines the process I will describe for you this morning in a practical way. by looking at Dickinson's relationship with women and men who had a formative influence on her development of her mature mind or intellectual thought, which can sometimes be very abstract and difficult for the layperson to comprehend at first glance. Although she's also read by school children, I should note. So there's another side to her, very simple. I've tried to give us a better portrait of who she was and what her poetry is really trying to convey to us in my book. And from a psychological angle, from a Jungian standpoint, I want to try to get to the deeper comprehension of her religious ideas or her spiritual thoughts. So von Franz's book helps us see that the primary aim in Jungian analysis is the withdrawal of projections from the outside world and the recollection of the archetype of the self onto outer figures in one's environment, in one's life, and the realization, the awakening of this archetype in oneself. This is also referred to in Zen Buddhism as the empty mind, the arrival at a state of a center. Emily Dickinson wrote that each life converges to some center, expressed or still, exists in every human nature, a goal. So each life converges towards some center, she says. This means that the movement toward the center, the self, the empty mind or Buddha mind, is the still point in everybody's spiritual evolution. This center is the place of cosmic consciousness, ecstasy, and absolute existence. Teilhard de Chardin and my friend Matthew Fox have referred to this as the cosmic Christ. So whatever metaphor we want to use, we're talking about the same thing. It's the place of love, being, and bliss. She says in a poem, love is like life. Love is the fellow of the resurrection, scooping up the dust and chanting, live. So here she's talking about the resurrection again. I'll have more to say about that as we proceed. About March, she said, "Dear March, come in. How glad am I? I hoped for you before." Emily Dickinson was not the recluse she has been portrayed by scholars and by history to be. She spent an equal amount of time in her garden, as she did in her room, where she wrote wild poetry. Listen, wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Futile the winds to a heart in port, done with the compass, done with the chart, rowing in Eden, ah, the sea, might I but moor tonight in thee? She also worked in the kitchen. She was a baker. She baked for her entire family. She loved life and she loved to observe nature, flowers, plants, trees, bees, butterflies, hummingbirds, which she cataloged in her poetry. She had to construct her own society, a group of people around her to support her vocation. This soul family consisted of her father Edward, her older brother Austin, her younger sister Lavinia, her sister-in-law Susan Gilbert, and her many friends with whom she corresponded by mail. Von Franz has an aim in the book I mentioned, and that is to get to the bottom of the projection-making process, to show through her remarkable erudition how the goal of Jungian analysis is to help a patient and presumably her readers learn how not to project anymore. This is also a name, she remarked, of Zen Buddhist meditation. She posited for analytical psychology 5 stages of the withdrawal of projections. She made it clear that Jung's notion of the self is meant to be understood as an experience that may put an end to projections. This, of course, is an ideal, as we continue to project throughout our life and have to continuously work to bring emptiness into our awareness. Her discussion on individuation and relatedness is especially pertinent to my psychobiography of Emily Dickinson, where the social function of the self, as she says, the reciprocal individuation, is a type of individuation where one gathers around oneself a soul family, a group not created by accident and projection, but by something more objective and arranged by the self. I think this is brilliant. Von Franz at her very best. I'll relate that to how that is pertinent to Unitarianism and to Emily's experience of withdrawing projections in relationship to a number of different people in her life who carried a religious attitude that she was trying to find out for herself to embody. The other members of Emily's soul family consisted of men of letters. These men all happened to be well-educated and spiritual or religious figures. I will name some of them in the discussion that follows and give you some of their history and what they meant to her individuation. There were also the Amherst girls, a number of young women, some of whom attended Amherst College, but mostly the young women who attended Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, where Emily went to school at the age of 17 in 1847. These were loving friendships, some of them erotic. And she wrote brilliant letters to these girls. This is one reason I call her bi-erotic in my book, because she loved women and men equally, with a full heart. A number of feminist scholars have recently attempted to give us a portrait of Emily Dickinson as a lesbian poet before her time. This is a reading that is certainly true, and I welcome this. However, I see her as bi-erotic in her basic psychological and spiritual orientation. And then there was the Newfoundland dog, Carlo, who her father purchased for her after he withdrew her from Mount Holyoke in 1848. The same year as the Seneca Falls Women's Convention that ignited the revolution in modern feminism. So Carlo would go on long walks with her, and she had a marvelous relationship with this big dog who she took out into the meadows in the Dickinson homestead. Historians who have given a false impression that she was a recluse, however, who never came out of her room, have given us a distorted and pathological impression of who she really was, I think. And this is what my book seeks to correct. During the last century, psychoanalysts also followed this pathologizing trend. It was a stigmatizing trend that created a set of illusions, and it was primarily a pejorative and toxic kind of sexist attitude that had diagnostic interpretations associated with it. That continues to today, where modern psychoanalysts are diagnosing Emily from the couch as schizoid, schizotypal, etc., etc., bipolar. Such portraits are simply untrue. according to the facts that I presented in my psychobiography of Emily. She brought to the world, rather, to her door. And she left it ajar. I've attempted in my book, therefore, to recreate a portrait of her as a healthy woman, one who lived the life of a shaman, a poet shamaness, who was not only relatively whole, but also a great medicine woman, who administered the medicine we need today to heal ourselves from toxic patriarchy. Medicine powers come through her poetry, the medicine of the snake. Snake was one of nature's people, she said. Such animal powers gave her strength. She knew, moreover, from her study of geology, that Vesuvius is located near the ancient Greek city of Pompeii. She knew Vesuvius was symbolized by the Greeks as a great serpent. She knew the power and wisdom of the serpent, the Kundalini energies that scalped her naked soul with paralyzing bliss. And she knew the cosmic serpent, the Milky Way, and the circumference of the cosmos. She embodied this cosmic energy in her writings. If I read a book and it makes my whole body so cold, no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry. If I feel physically as if the top of my head were taken off, I know that is poetry. Is there any other way? She asked Colonel Higginson, her mentor and spiritual advisor, who was a Unitarian minister in 1863. Higginson led a regiment of black Civil War soldiers for the North in the Civil War. He was also a feminist and organized women's gatherings following the Selma, Seneca Falls. Jungian slip. You see how we're all psychoanalyzed these days. Thomas Higginson, a Unitarian minister, was mind-boggled, really baffled, brought to his knees when he staggered out of his first interview with Emily Dickinson, the poetess, not comprehending what he had just heard or from whom such words had issued forth. These were the words of a medicine woman speaking, the fierce listener. Listen, and you will hear the words of a priestess, a poet, and a shaman, a dispenser of sacred medicine. What she dispenses is the medicine of immortality, to overcome the fear of death. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put aside my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed a school where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun. We passed a hill in the ground, the cornice in the ground. The cornice is a coffin. And then she says, and now seems shorter than a day, the horses' heads were toward eternity. Emily Dickinson's mother had a tremulous fear of death, and Emily grew up in this emotional environment in relationship to a mother who was probably suffering from some kind of anxiety. This question preoccupied her, the question of whether the soul survives death. It became her flood subject, as she called it. Immortality was her flood subject. One of the central themes, next to death, which is probably the primary theme in her poetry, was immortality. And she had read Dante, by the way. Death takes us all in the end. She saw many people die around her, and she survived the Civil War. Death is democratic, she said then. Death is our great liberator. Death is our great teacher, our comforter. Death is kind. Death is civil, in her poem. In the carriage she rode in the poem with death and immortality, the horses' heads in this great death soliloquy were tending towards eternity. Emily is a great teacher of near-death experiences. She was an introvert in an extroverted society. But her aim in her poems was to reach American society and the world. Her ambition was really that great, and she succeeded. The Society of Emily Dickinson Scholarship is a burgeoning culture now. We're attracted to Emily Dickinson, even though we may fear her. We fear her lifestyle. We fear her closeness to madness, to solitude, to death. And yet, all of the great shamans, saints, and mystics of the world tell us that we can only know who we truly are through annihilation, dismemberment, or crucifixion of the ego. Crucifixion is a theme that is present in Emily Dickinson's poetry, not because she was obsessed with Christian ideas and the theology of various denominations, but because it was something she felt she had experienced in her bones. Crucifixion is a theme in her poetry because she herself felt she was crucified. She carried her own crucifix. In a psychological sense, she really was. She died. This was the way she died. And when her breath was done, she took her little wardrobe and headed for the sun. Her little figure at the gate, the angels must have spied, since I could never find her upon the mortal side. The ego of the poetess cannot find her who has gone beyond. Nevertheless, she feels that she has gone beyond. She has achieved her own resurrection of the spirit. She is at the gate of heaven and going through the gate in imagination, as Dante did also. Immortality was her flood subject, as I said. It was also a favorite subject of the yogis of India. She didn't need faith in Christ's resurrection alone without works. The Bible was to her an antique volume, as she said, written by faded men. Here's a feminist poem for you. She wrote what she described in a letter to her little cousins, a diagnosis of the Bible. She diagnosed what was ill in it, namely the excision of the feminine, of the goddess. Unitarianism helped her find her freedom, but it did not become her endpoint. Emily saw that science and spirituality were one. They needn't be separated. I'm not a theologian, and I'm not a Unitarian. I'm a Jungian, or a post-Jungian. What this means is that I look empirically from a scientific standpoint at the evolution of the poet's thoughts from a psychological angle. And what I find in the life of Dickinson is the same principle that I find in the poetry of Walt Whitman, a form of spirituality that is democratic at its roots. She called the religion of her parents an eclipse because they worshipped a father in heaven alone, our Father as in the Lord's Prayer. This patriarchal God was an eclipse to her. She called the Lord's Prayer eclipse because, according to science, There is no Father in heaven without a mother in heaven. The two are one. There is a divine masculine and a divine feminine. She was bringing a new God image into historical Christianity through her poetry, and nobody knew it in her lifetime. So she called herself a nobody. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? She was surpassing the theologians and religious thinkers of the church, soaring on wings of a bird of passage, like all shamans do, across vast vistas of consciousness to the spirit that has no gender, no name and no form, to the void or the Godhead. Now, after this little introduction, I'd like to meditate on a theme that I hope will be of great interest to the Unitarian Universalist Personal Theology Group. And that is the theme of Emily Dickinson, the Orthodox Trinitarian Congregational Church of Amherst, Unitarianism, and the emergence of spiritual democracy in her poetry. So the liberal Unitarians of Boston and Harvard University made an enormous impact on the religious evolution of the United States by the time Emily Dickinson entered Mount Holyoke Female Seminary in the fall of 1847. Congregational Trinitarians at Yale, Dartmouth, and Williams Universities had also had an impact on the religious development of the nation at roughly the same time. 1847 was a pivotal point, therefore, in the development of religious ideas on the North American continent. Big changes were taking place in the United States. In 1847, America was in the grip of a religious revival. American society experienced three great awakenings during Emily Dickinson's lifetime. The first began in the year of Emily's birth, 1830. She was born on December 10th. The second revival, typically referred to as the Third Awakening, began prior to the year of her emergence as a poet in 1857. This was the biggest revival movement Emily experienced. It lasted for approximately 3 years, between 1857 to 1860, just prior to the outbreak of the Civil War. It is estimated by some historians that during the Second Awakening, over 2 million conversions to Christianity occurred across the United States over a three-year period. Another religious revival began in the year 1882, 4 years prior to the poet's death on May 15, 1886. Such awakenings in American society were times of organized prayer meetings, birthing of denominations in periods of fear-making, shame, and guilt that spread like a virus through the nation, namely because of the doctrine of original sin, which Emily didn't believe in. Despite the presence and pressures of these movements, these revivals, Emily felt from the polarization between Unitarians and Trinitarians taking place all around her in Amherst that she had to resist the pressure to convert to anyone's religion other than to remain true to her own vision. She was one of the greatest visionaries of spiritual democracy that ever lived. "Some keep the Sabbath going to church," she said. "I keep it staying at home." It was the Trinitarian dispensation that formed the inception of Emily Dickinson's famous hymn poems, which consciously rejected the common forms and meters of her day. Raised in a Calvinist household, Emily attended the First Trinitarian Church, Congregational Church of Amherst. Congregationalism was the major religion in New England at this time, followed by Unitarianism. The Orthodox Congregational Church the future poetess attended had been founded by her grandfather, Samuel Fowler Dickinson. He was co-founder of Amherst College, a Trinitarian school for Christian missionaries, whose central aim was to teach young men to convert the heathens by bringing them in faith and education to Jesus Christ. The central doctrine of the Congregationalists was the doctrine of original sin, a doctrine against which Emily would later rebel. She was a revolutionary. At Mount Holyoke, Emily found the mentor she needed to help free her mind from the childhood religion of her ancestors. The main teacher of the young girls at the seminary was Mary Lyon, an intense, serious, and strongly religious woman who was a protege of Edward Hitchcock, a famous geologist, paleontologist, botanist, and the third president of Amherst College during the years when Emily was coming into her full poetic power. On October 17, 1847, Sunday morning, Hitchcock preached to the girls at Mount Holyoke and teachers. Although he was a Trinitarian preacher like Samuel Dickinson, her grandfather, he'd been humbled by the study of science, by the grandeur of God's works in nature. The text Hitchcock's Sunday sermon meditated upon was Revelations 21, Emily Dickinson's favorite chapter in the King James Bible. She called it her gem chapter. It's pertinent for a geologist to be meditating on this. And the building of the wall of it was jasper, and the city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, and so on, and the seventh chrysolite, and the ninth topaz, and the twelfth an amethyst. Emily was in awe. Amazed, really. Later in the afternoon, Hitchcock's text focused on the lines from Matthew, "Enter ye at the strait gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go in threat. Because strait is the gate, and narrow is the way which leads us unto life, and few there be that find it." Her little figure at the gate, the angels could have spied, since I could never find her upon the mortal side. You see how these verses from the Bible entered her mature poetry and the metaphors. Hitchcock, a distinguished botanist, geologist, and Trinitarian Congregationalist pastor, was professor of chemistry and natural theology at Amherst College from 1825 until his death in 1864. His Sunday sermon stayed with Emily for the rest of her lifetime and inspired some of her most important poems. Hitchcock's natural theology freed Emily from the patriarchal doctrine of original sin. It opened her mind up to the possibility of finding her own way to spiritual democracy, although she already had a clear sense of it since her earliest childhood years during her experiences in nature. Hitchcock's geology revolutionized Emily Dickinson's thinking. The way in which transformations of consciousness occurred in her is a subject that has not been explored at much depth by Dickinson scholars, for the simple reason that up till recently, the field of Dickinson's studies has lacked the necessary psychological machinery to unmask the mystery of how a metamorphosis such as the one she experienced could have taken place in so simple a mind. Dickinson was terribly misunderstood by her contemporaries, and her spiritual evolution has continued to be misinterpreted, even by modern-day psychoanalysts. Illusions grew up around her that have thrown readers off the track of understanding who she was. So I'm not going to read the rest of the paper to you. Instead, I'm going to try and describe the rest of it, because I can see that I'm starting to wind this down. But the main focus in the paper is on this process that von Franz described as the withdrawal of projections. And the relationship that Emily had to important religious figures in her life who helped her realize the self. These were, interestingly, Ben Newton, who became her tutor after her father withdrew her from Mount Holyoke Female Seminary. He was a law student in her father's law offices, and he gave her private instruction. He was a Unitarian, and he was an Emersonian. And he gave Emily the essays and the poetry of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Now, coming from a Calvinist background, a Trinitarian background of her grandfather, who wanted to convert the world to Trinitarianism, the Unitarian worldview opened up Emily's mind. It opened up vistas. It opened up perspectives. She read, without any doubt, the poem Brahma by Emerson. And she must have been amazed at the breadth of Emerson's vision. But she didn't become a transcendentalist either. She had to find her own path, what I call a self-path. The second important person in her life was Samuel Bowles. Samuel Bowles was the editor of the Springfield Republican. Emily met him right before, or right at the point where something miraculous happened in her psyche, a metamorphosis that she describes. Three times we parted, she said in a poem, breath and I. Three times. Did she have some kind of near-death experience? Three times we parted, breath and I. At the end of the poem, she says, and sunrise kissed my chrysalis, and I stood up and lived. So you get the image of a metamorphosis that she also observed in her garden when she watched caterpillars turning into chrysalis, turning into the butterfly. She saw the same processes in nature as being identical with the psychological processes that she herself was going through her own inner work. Samuel Bowles published a few of Emily's poems. Seven poems were published in her lifetime out of 1,775. Not to mention her letters, which are voluminous. Seven poems. These were all Baudelaireized. They were altered. Alter me, she said. She refused. She decided that publication was the auction of the mind of man. And success is counted sweetest by those who never succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires the sorest need. Samuel Bowles was a Unitarian. So here's a second man in her life onto whom she projected the image of the sacred masculine or the divine masculine. She saw him as a kind of carrier of an attitude that helped free her from the Trinitarian dogma. And it opened her up. Then, after things evolved and she began to find her own stride as a poet in 1858, when she wrote 50 poems, and then in 1859, another 100 or so, and then 1860, 1861, another few hundred, and then suddenly in 1862, she wrote over 360 poems in a single year. We're talking about a big outpouring verse. That year, she began a correspondence with Thomas Wentworth Higginson. Higginson was a Unitarian minister. Higginson was a mentor to her and spiritual advisor. So she looked to him to help answer questions for herself about these burning questions that she had concerning whether the soul survives after death. And Higginson did his best to respond, but the answers were already within Emily. At the age of 4, she had been to a funeral where she heard the minister say before the coffin in the ground, "What is the Lord that the arm of the Lord cannot save?" And she took the accent on "cannot" to be a doubt about the question of immortality. So you can see that with the anxiety of her mother, who had this tremulous fear of death, and then this experience, you could say a trauma at the age of 4 of hearing this, and you could see how precocious she is, that she's already beginning to wonder if the accent in the talk of the minister was a doubt about immortality. This stayed with her for the rest of her life. Now, in the book, I give a number of examples of how she overcame the fear of death through experience. She had inner experiences where, as I've cited for you already, she felt she had undergone a crucifixion, a death to her ego, and then a resurrection of a new soul, you could say, a butterfly soul that desired to soar and greet the world. What stymied her was the problem around publication. And this is a subject that I look at in my book, in addition to the question about the three mysterious, quote, master letters with a capital M. She wrote three letters that were not published until 1995 by Thomas Johnson, all addressed to a mysterious figure who she called the Master. Now, Dickinson scholars, historians of American poetry and literature, have sought to identify who the Master was. Was it Samuel Bowles? Was it Charles Wadsworth, who she heard speak? He was a Presbyterian minister in Philadelphia in 1855, when her father, who was a representative in the House of Representatives, he was in the Massachusetts Senate, he was a lawyer. She went with her sister Lavinia to George Washington's home. But she also heard this profound sermon by a man who she would correspond with named Charles Wadsworth. Well, historians have tried to find evidence that the Master was an external figure. What I've suggested in my book is that the Master was what in the East is referred to as a guru. Carl Jung himself took instruction from his own inner guru, who he called Philemon. So I use a Jungian analytical framework to suggest that this archetype, you could say, of the Master, the self within Emily, really was an internal figure that she sought instruction from, and later addressed in these letters and in her poetry. She also addresses the Master in a few poems. So I see Emily Dickinson basically as an awakener. during a time of the Great Awakenings. She was at the forefront of the movement of female empowerment. She told her sister next door, sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert, that in the Lord's Prayer, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever," right? Amen. She said, "Cherish power, dear." So you see how bold she was, how progressive, how experimental, and how psychologically minded she was before modern psychoanalysis had emerged. "This ecstatic nation," she says, "seek, it is yourself," with a capital Y. So, what I've tried to paint for you this morning is a picture of a young woman who at 17 began to study science, who learned under a Trinitarian, George Hitchcock, for whom the unity of the spirit and nature was really one of a kind of a integrity within the Christian framework. And this helped free her from the orthodox Trinitarianism of her grandfather. Fortunately, her father, Edward, was a lawyer who was very liberally minded. He also helped her, as did her brother Austin, who went to Yale and who became a lawyer and also encouraged Emily in her writing of poetry. She called him Brother Pegasus, the winged horse. So you can see how she's projecting onto these male figures in her environment something of her own spiritual nature that wants to take wing. Then she meets her preceptor, Ben Newton, a Unitarian, and who's also an Emersonian, a transcendentalist. That helps loosen her strictures, you could say, of her mind. And then she meets Samuel Bowles, another Unitarian, who also, she writes 150 letters to him. And I mean, poems. I don't know how many letters, but 150 poems. Then she meets Higginson, who becomes her mentor and spiritual advisor, also a Unitarian. So what she's doing is she's projecting the masculine component of her personality, the sacred masculine or the divine masculine, onto these men of letters. But then she begins to withdraw these projections. And what happens is the lightning flash. She remembers what she saw at 2 on the road to Monson with her grandmother when her head was covered with a cloak. And she herself becomes illuminated by light, the lightning bolt. And she describes this in her poetry, that she was scalped by Doom's electric moccasin. The moccasin, the Native American moccasins that are walking across the sky. These are the lightning beings. She's bringing a Native American kind of spirituality into her poetry here. She finds her own voice and her own spirituality. I wouldn't call it a personal theology. I would call it her personal myth, her subjective story, her narrative. She didn't want to convert anybody to any ideas of her own. She wanted to offer them as the news of the universe, as she said, freely, for those who would take her poems. She didn't have many takers. 7 poems was not a large sample. How could anyone have known what she had produced until her poems were published by none other than Higginson after her death? So another interesting synchronicity, a coincidence, is that a Unitarian helped to bring her into the world along with her brother's mistress, Mabel Loomis Todd. Lavinia, her sister, found a packet of 800 poems that had neatly been sewn together in 40 booklets. 800 poems. The rest were loose leaf. These were intended for publication posthumously. I think she knew that her poems would become part of the general consciousness, that everybody could appreciate and learn from, that it was only a matter of time, that it was her destiny to find her way into print in a sexist period of time when the editors told her her poems were too soft, they didn't fit the conventional meters of her day. She had to put them in her own verses. These were the homilies. She wrote these poems in the form of the homily in the Trinitarian Church from Watts, the Watts hymns, so that the poems themselves resemble in some way hymns that she intended to be published in exactly the way that she wrote them, with all of her characteristic dashes, with her capitalizations, with her very unique punctuation. And in 1855, thanks to Thomas Johnson, 1,775 poems, including her letters, were published, and the three master letters, in exactly the way, or as close as could be, in reading her manuscripts, the way she intended them. So this is right before the second wave of feminism, 1955, which would happen in the 60s. And I think we're at a fourth wave now, when not only the divine feminine is coming into our spiritual consciousness, but also the divine feminine in the male psyche, in men. And if anybody has something to offer us, a gift of the spirit from the 19th century and from America, I think it's Emily Dickinson. So I think that pretty much does it. I see a hand in the back. It's Lonnie.
So love you, Stephen. Laurie, thank you for letting people just love him. Can you do my mother? I need a book on my mother. This was fabulous. Did you notice anything with Rumi and Dickinson in any sets of poetry, you know, that she did?
That she had read Rumi?
Yeah.
It's not clear whether she read Hafez. The only poets who really, the Sufi poets, who were being read at the time were Sa'di, primarily, who was translated some by Emerson, but mainly Hafez. Over 200 ghazals were translated by Ralph Waldo Emerson. I don't know if Emily Dickinson put her eyes on those. I don't know that Rumi was popular back then, in America anyway. Yes,
yeah,
David.
Her drive toward independence and individuation reminds me of the teaching of Eric Fromm. In 1941, he wrote Escape from Freedom, writing about the fascist movement then underway in Europe, and how hard it is for an individual to drive toward independence, mm-hmm. and how an individual pursuing that is not going to get a lot of accolades or prizes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for that, David. I use the metaphor of liberty. She wrote during the Civil War, By the way, she said that about the American self, she referred to it as the Ethiope within, with a capital E. At the time, Ethiope was a common term for African. She said also that, to respond to your comment, David, that she was not going to be chained. And she used the metaphor of slavery, the chains of slavery during the Civil War, being unshackled by, like the Statue of Liberty, she has chains at her feet, which she's thrown off. Dickinson is a poet of American liberty and American religious freedom. So I think that you're right. I think she was a fierce Democrat. She was a fierce individual. And her father, Edward, probably helped her understand some of the religious clauses in the U.S. Constitution. Yeah. You're right, and oftentimes that's true about the individual, that she goes unrecognized in her lifetime.
Question here. I read Dickinson and Emerson. I read Dickinson and Emerson in a different way. I think the big influence on both of them was a direct experience of reincarnation. And in one particular poem of Dickinson's, the one with the snake, she actually remembers being a boy. And I would find it hard to take seriously the possibility that she was speaking of her own experience when she talked about things that happen after death.
You find it hard to believe that she was speaking about actual experiences of what happens?
The possibility that she actually experienced reincarnation.
I don't know that I overlook the possibility. I don't mention it. But I'm certainly very open to the possibility that Emily Dickinson... Well, this is exactly why a Jungian analytical form of interpretation helps us, I think, in helping to understand the factor of historical memory, archetypal memory, memory that is in the land, memory that is in nature. A narrow fellow in the grass, when a boy and barefoot, I more than once at noon spied a whiplash unbraiding in the sun. It wrinkled and was gone. Yeah, that's one of her most beautiful poems, I think. And was it an actual experience that she had? I think it was. I think she actually did see the snake and observed it very keenly. She was a scientist at heart and a natural scientist. But, as I also mentioned, I think she was awakening centers in her brain that go back to the archaic memory of the snake, which we find in Kundalini yoga, that these memories can be recovered, whether they're memories of reincarnation or archetypal memory. I mean, that's open for it's a question, and I don't know that we have a definite answer to that. Thank you.
Over here. Excuse me. I'm curious. Why did her father pull her out of Mount Holyoke?
That's a very good question. I don't think I have the full answer to that question. There's some unclarity about it, really, in the biographies I've read. It's not entirely clear. And whether it was fully her father who pulled her out or whether Emily telling her father that she did not want to go anymore. And one of the hypotheses I look at in my book is the question about whether it was Emily's resistance to becoming a bride of Christ, with a capital B. The young women at Mount Holyoke were all being converted by Mary Lyon to become brides of Christ and to be prepared for motherhood and wifehood in New England society. Emily said she left her spool and her needle at the sewing society. She left the sewing society. And what she did was she sewed those seams in her poetry. That was her form of spiritual that's a good question. I don't know fully how that played itself out.
Other questions?
When you said the problem of publication, I found that very interesting. I wanted to invite you if you could say a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. And also, as a second question, what if Emily only had Twitter to express her poetry through? How do you think that might like shift her spiritual lens?
If she only had what? I'm sorry.
If she only had Twitter.
To
publish poetry, yeah.
I think she would have astounded us with her metaphors. In fact, some of her poems are, 150 characters? How many? 44? Something like that. I think some of those poems are like that. They're quick bolts of melody, as she said. But really, you have to read the full, the quatrains. I mean, she wrote sometimes long poems, and not like Whitman did, but to get back to your question about publication, we don't have much evidence for her outrage, but I think she was outraged that her poems were not accepted the way that she wrote them. She did not want her poems tampered with, including Snake. In fact, it was over Snake, or we could call it The Narrow Fellow in the Grass, that she protested the loudest over, and particularly to Higginson. She said that her meter and her lines had been changed, and she was clearly not happy with that. She had a colleague at Mount Holyoke who became a famous female novelist, Helen Hunt Jackson. She wrote two novels as an advocate for Native Americans. She ended up in Santa Barbara. Emily wrote poems in her letters to her, one of which was a poem that Helen had encouraged her to publish her poems. This is near the end of her life now, 1885. She died the following year. Helen died three months after this letter. So both of these young women are at the end of their life, both early deaths. One a published author, well known, and one virtually unknown. We don't hear about Helen Hunt Jackson too much these days. We hear a lot about Emily Dickinson. What she wrote is as follows to Helen when Helen had asked her to publish her poem about the hummingbird, A Path of Evanescence. She wrote, "Take all away from me, but leave me ecstasy, and I am richer than all my fellow men." See how she says it? Men. "I am richer than all my fellow men. Ill it behooveth me to dwell so wealthily when at my very door are those possessing more in abject poverty." Wow. I don't know what to say about the problem of publication. I think you can hear a tone of anger when she says, publication is the auction of the mind of man. Emily Dickinson desperately wanted to be published. She desired it. She wished for it sorely. She had to deal with discrimination. She had to deal with sexism, with stereotypes.
Hi, I'm over here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I heard the anger.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. My question actually is about Marie-Louise von Franz.
Yes.
I've read her book on projection. I read it several times. Mm-hmm. It's foundational in how I listen to people and myself. I put it together slightly differently than you did, mm-hmm. and I'd just like to throw it out there.
Please.
To see what you think. I see we learn everything by projection. To me, every time something in our the unconscious in our psyche is getting ready to cross the threshold into consciousness, it crosses via a projection. We mm-hmm. follow Marie-Louise's five stages mm-hmm. of, and I think of it as re-owning the projection where we see, oh, it's not a spirit in every single rock and tree. I am sentient. Oh, it's not that I have to summon Hephaestus to be mm-hmm. successful as a smith. I am the smith. And as we go up the stages uh-huh. of cognition, we re-own whatever we have projected. Oh, we don't have to see God as a great man with a white mm-hmm. beard in the sky handing down the limestone tablets. There is an innate moral law. There is an innate mm-hmm. natural law as we go up mm-hmm. the stages of cognition. Mm-hmm. So I want to rephrase it as it's not that we stop projecting, it's mm-hmm. that we become more transparent to the fact that we are necessarily projecting mm-hmm. and we re-own our projections and become more humble and mm-hmm. open to say, oh, that it's not that person being irritatingly self-righteous, I am irritatingly self-righteous. Mm-hmm. We become more able to mm-hmm. re-own our projections as mm-hmm. we become more mature. So I just wanted to throw that out there to see.
Yes, thank you.
What you have to say about it.
Yeah, no, it was very nicely stated, and it helps to complement what I said about how she withdrew her projections from these Unitarian men in her life.
That's
yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So just very early on, you talked about being a post-Jungian?
Myself?
Yes.
Yeah.
Could you contrast it with Jung, being a Jungian and migrating to post-Jungian, my understanding?
That's why I said Jungian or post-Jungian. I really don't know what I am. Andrew Samuels published the definitive text on Jung and the post-Jungians. So I recommend that book for anybody interested in what that term means. But post-Jungian would be someone who's not a classical Jungian. We'd consider Marie-Louise von Franz a classical Jungian. The later generation Jungians are beginning to use that term, post-Jungians. I really don't like it that much myself. But
you used it, that's all.
I threw it out there. thanks for asking. That's really a good question. I mean, I don't consider myself a Jungian either entirely. I mean, I have my own. I mean, Emily Dickinson, right? She didn't want to. She didn't belong to any church, and not that the Jungians are any kind of religious group or anything like that. And they're just a bunch of psychotherapists who follow the teachings of a great man.
We saw some guy had some bowel problems on a church once.
Oh my goodness, what a great memory. Yes. Yes, yes. I hope
that.
You didn't.
It's a striking image.
It is a striking image, yeah. Yeah.
It's bothered a lot of Episcopalian ministers ever since.
I'll bet, yeah. Yeah.
Can you sum that up in like a little sound bite? That's
Emily Dickinson, as the Dickinson scholar who wrote a biography on her, it was his doctoral dissertation. He's a William Everson scholar as well, and Robinson Jeffers scholar. I met him down in Carmel, a very nice man. He's a professor emeritus at Stanford University, Albert Gelpy. He said that Emily Dickinson was never disrespectful towards organized religion or Christianity. And she always maintained an attitude of humility, which is, as you all know, amongst the highest Christian virtues. I see her as extremely modest. Her decision not to publish was an act of modesty. It doesn't get more modest than that. You know, she was like a sage, I think, in some ways, like a Lao Tzu. You know, modesty was the highest virtue in Taoism, in Chinese philosophy. Emily Dickinson embodies this beautifully, this virtue. Yeah, Barbara.
Okay, I think since we have all of Stephen's books for sale over here, and they're a great discount, $20 each. So I think we'll end here, and thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming this morning, and it's been my pleasure. Yeah.